Support comes from the St. Louis Chamber Chorus. Season 68 concludes at John Burroughs at 3 p.m. on May 26th with the United Nations commissioned Voices of Today by composer Benjamin Britten, featuring youth and adult singers. Tickets at chamberchorus.org.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. The grandeur of the 1904 World's Fair is a big part of St. Louis's identity, even after 120 years. It's the focus of the cornerstone exhibit at the Missouri History Museum. It also holds the distinction of being the longest-running exhibit in the museum's history. But last April, it was closed for reimagining and renovations. This past weekend, the upgraded 1904 World's Fair exhibit finally opened to the public. I spoke last month with Sharon Smith, curator of civic and personal identity at the Missouri History Museum, and Sam Moore, managing director of public history at the Missouri History Museum. We discussed what motivated changes and how the museum is tackling the fair's troubling history. Our conversation started with Sam explaining why Missourians are still enamored of the St. Louis World's Fair after all these years.
The World's Fair really was turn-of-the-century America, the place you wanted to be. If you think about the Olympics today, there's a bit of a parallel. Cities would vie for World's Fairs. They drew huge crowds. The eyes of the world were on your particular city, and St. Louis wanted to be that city, and that certainly paid off for St. Louis because 20 million people came to that fair.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sharon, in the introduction, I had mentioned the World's Fair, it happened 120 years ago. And last year when I talked with Jody Sowell of Missouri History Museum about the closing of the exhibit and sort of the redoing of it, we did talk a little bit about why it is folks are still obsessed, quote unquote, mm-hmm. with the World's Fair. From your perspective, why has it remained such a such an object of fascination and interest?
Yeah. I think that part of it is because it's one of those moments where if you think about St. Louis's history, almost anybody can remember that that is one of the things that happened here. You know, 1904 is a huge pinnacle for the St. Louis history whenever we talk about it, even at the History Museum, right? It's always there. It's always been an exhibit that we've talked about. And I think it's because it was such a grand moment for the city. Again, 20 million people show up. It's not something to be forgotten very easily. Mm-hmm. And you've got whole groups of people who constantly are thinking about that. The World's Fair Society, for instance, lots of people who still want to perpetuate that memory. So, you know, we're part of that as well by telling that story. And the fact that we sit in a place where the museum sits at the opening where the fair was. So, right. So we get to tell that story in a big way.
Mm-hmm. And you've been with the History Museum for quite some time now, including the period sort of leading up to the original exhibit. How much of what you've described sort of animated the creation of the exhibit in its first iteration?
Yeah, we've done numerous exhibits on the World's Fair. The one that most recently closed was the second one of the three now big ones that I've seen.
Okay.
But it was the most complex of those exhibits, and yet this one looks to be even more so. I think mm-hmm. we're finally getting to a point where we're really wanting to tell every facet of that story that we can absolutely tell, right? Mm-hmm. So not just the grandeur and the wonder of the fair, the beauty of the fair, in all of its famous photographs that people are able to remember what they see every time they come into an exhibit, but more the complexity, more of the harder stories that we haven't necessarily told in the past. So mm-hmm. I'm excited for that.
Yeah. So the World's Fair, when we were talking earlier, Sam, about why hosting was such a big deal, it did bring in, did you say 22 million?
20 million. Just shy of 20 million. There's a very specific number that's just shy of 20.
Okay. So, you know, it clearly left a mark. You're in a museum that is located mm-hmm. on the grounds. How else was it that the fair at that time How did it impact the city? And maybe what are some of the elements of those like facets of history that are not as broadly talked about were also part of some of the ways that the fair affected St. Louis?
Sure. So not only does the 1904 World's Fair put St. Louis on the map for the rest of the world in a very big way, we had to do some major, major work here in St. Louis to get ready for a fair like that. So Forest Park today is not a forest. There are forested parts of Forest Park, but we had to clear an entire forest to make way for the fair. Mm-hmm. We had to reinvent St. Louis's water system to make way for the fair. And then the fair leaves behind money, because it's one of the few fairs to turn a profit, and also allows us today to have things like the Jefferson Memorial Building, to have things like the World's Fair Pavilion in Forest Park. So there's some very tangible kind of infrastructure and building-related remnants of the fair. And then I think also, again, putting St. Louis on the map for the rest of the world when it is the fourth largest city in the nation, but a pretty distant fourth to third place Philadelphia. this was a big moment for the city. It was a big moment for the city to get some messages across, and also, frankly, for the United States to get some messages across that it really wanted to share with the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. So who was the fair made for?
Who was the fair made for? That's a great question. Who was the fair made for? I think the fair has a few different goals. The United States wants to project a forward-looking, optimistic vision for its future. It wants to present certain acquisitions that it has made in the last few years, acquisitions like the Philippines. We annexed the Philippines in 1898 and had a whole 40-plus acre display, essentially a human zoo dedicated to that. It is for St. Louisans. It's for the world. I think, I'm going to have to think on that question. Yeah. That's a really good one. I don't know if Sharon has anything to add on that.
Yeah, Sharon. I mean, maybe to that point, or to follow on that point, who was it not made for?
Yeah, that's part of the complexity, right, of where we are today when we look at doing an exhibit like this. I think it was made for anybody who could afford it, number one, right? You know, so obviously there's an admission fee. So right away that gets to who could afford to either get into the turnstiles, also afford to come to the fair. Mm. So you've already made it a classist sort of an event, right?
Sure.
In that regard. But then there were workers who could get on the fairgrounds. And then there was the whole idea of portraying a hierarchy of you know, how people were civilized. I mean, we're talking 1904, not 2024. So in 1904, people were trying to understand how that all worked.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're trying to project that notion that, you know, we're an imperialist country now, we've got this acquisition, here's what we've acquired, and trying to make all of those distinctions, I think it's for the people for whom that would be most important. And again, mm-hmm. it's going to be that group of people that could afford to get into the fair, right? So I think that's really part of it. I think it was, and then there were a lot of people that did not make it onto the fairgrounds for whatever reasons, and we can certainly get into that. And I also think that the other part that Sam was speaking of with, you know, what all was going on, there was also this notion of a competition of trying to be the best fair ever, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you compare it to the fairs that had gone right before it, the biggest being before that would have been in Chicago.
Chicago, right.
So they're trying to compete in that way and make St. Louis look better. So for themselves, maybe, for the city fair planners, it was a win if they did that.
Mm-hmm. And is there maybe one aspect that has carried over from the previous iteration of the exhibit that has been complicated in some way, sort of in the way that you've talked about, where it was a point of pride, but you've sort of problematized it in a way that presents a more nuanced way of understanding?
Well, also a good question. you're making us work here. I think, you know, I do think that, again, because in past exhibits, I think it's been easy to talk about the grandeur. And I think when we've tried to talk about sort of the human zoos, the exhibited people, the people who were left out. It's been the focus of doing it through the most recent exhibit that was up previously. We tried to look at people who were at the fair by what they wore, right? Mm-hmm. So if you were wearing your grand clothing, you were the fairgoer. If you were wearing some sort of uniform, you were maybe a guard, so you had a job to do. But if you were wearing something that looked like native clothing, chances are you were in one of the exhibited villages on the fairgrounds or on the pike. And so by virtue of clothing, that made it a simple way to tell that story.
Sure.
But not nearly diving deep enough into the complexity. And I think that's what we're unearthing in this exhibit, is that deeper complexity of what did that mean, and using it through voices that are not necessarily ours, meaning the folks who created the exhibit, us museum people, mm-hmm. but through people who are partnering with us in that telling of that story.
Mm-hmm. So, Sam, I'd like to bring it to today. Who is the new version of the exhibit for? And is there maybe one or two key changes that have been made that reflect who that audience is?
Sure. So I think the goal behind this exhibit, and certainly all of our exhibits at the Missouri History Museum, is for St. Louisans to introduce them to a St. Louis they've never met before, to unpack these different layers and aspects to stories they may know well or know parts of well, and broaden that understanding a little bit more. And then, of course, a big part of our audience comes from outside of St. Louis. They may only be passing through. And so this effort with the New World's Fair exhibit really says, let us tell you about something you know, at least know the date of, and may know about the Ferris wheels and the ice cream cones of it all. Let us take you a couple layers deeper in that for both our local community here in St. Louis and folks who are only passing through St. Louis. I think the way that we do that first and foremost inside the exhibit is with a massive scale model of the 1,200-acre fairgrounds. So Sharon and I were just actually talking before we came on the air about the fact that we've been, for most of our careers, looking at pictures of the fair, looking at the buildings from the fair, mm-hmm. but have never seen it laid out spatially before, right?
Okay.
Just incredible, remarkable piece that allows you to step into the fair in a fascinating way, and also brings you closer to the idea that this was massive and it was overwhelming and it was spaced out in a very intentional way.
Mm-hmm. Was public input at all part of how you all approached this redo or update of the exhibit?
Yeah, so we have, over the past couple of years, as we've gotten closer and closer to kind of closing the old show and opening the new one, right, have worked with some really excellent partners across our community. Partners like Linda Nance, who's the past national president of the National Association for Colored Women's Clubs, who very visibly and vocally protested segregation at the fair in 1904. Folks like Jonna Langholtz, who's the caretaker of the Philippine Village Historic Site in present-day Clayton, Des Moines. And so working with those core partners to tell these stories that we know our visitors are looking for, right? They're very interested in the wonder of the fair. They're also very interested in the complexity of the fair and are, want to be able to have both of those things in their hands and consider both of those things when they're visiting. And we can't tell those stories. We wouldn't have been able to tell those stories as fully as we are in this exhibit without the support of core partners like that.
Mm-hmm. So each of you have used the word complexity a number of times. What does that mean? And how is that being unpacked, maybe through a very specific component of the new version of this exhibit, Sharon?
I think for me, the way I understand how we're using it, it has to do with as much the honesty of the complete story, right? Because I think for many years, even I, in the way that I've presented it in conversations or talks that I've done, you want to talk about the grandeur because that's the thing that people most know, right? Mm-hmm. That's the beauty of the fair. That's the big palaces. And it's easy to sort of just gloss over that because that's such a big deal. And so I think the complexity means that we get at those layers of trying to understand from perspectives beyond my own what that would look like if I were of a different origin or a different nationality. Mm-hmm. How did that look for people who were coming into the fairgrounds that all they saw were, certain groups of people in exhibited fashion and not walking around in grand clothing, right? Mm-hmm. Because they weren't a fairgoer. So I think trying to just get at the heart of that and know that that's really at the heart of what the museum is. It's telling everybody's story mm-hmm. and as deep a way as possible. That's complex.
Right.
And it gets at the heart of really telling all of history, not just focusing on something that's easy.
Right.
It's getting at the hard parts of the story as well.
What parts were hardest to sort of get into or get around to dig deeper on? You know, this, what you'd mentioned, Sharon, earlier about the fair experience being different for different people. Mm-hmm. How is that something that practically visitors to the museum are going to not going to be able to avoid sort of confronting it?
Sure. Yeah. So you're going to see the grandeur of the fair, and you will also be confronted with this idea that as a Black fairgoer, your experience could look fundamentally different, right? You most likely could get in the gates of the fair, but you wouldn't necessarily be able to do all of the things that white fairgoers could do. And then on the other hand, we have this fascinating oral history that the Missouri Historical Society collected in the early 20th century, or rather in the 1970s, from a fairgoer who went as a child, who went as a young Black girl, and rode the Ferris wheel and mm-hmm. engaged with the fair. And so that's complex, right? We have very unequal and uneven experiences happening at the fair, depending on your skin color. And even if you are a Black person, sometimes that experience looks different depending on your age and the day that you're there even. This idea of a place where there were wonderful shows to watch. There were also reenactments of battles from the Boer Wars in the late 19th century. And they were being fought by very real veterans of those wars who mm-hmm. had only finished fighting each other on a real battlefield 2-3 years earlier. Those are stories that are interwoven throughout. In between Festival Hall and Ice Cream Cones, we're also grappling with these stories that would have been enjoyed by fairgoers, that would have been familiar to fairgoers, but that maybe are a little bit less familiar with our visitors and St. Louisans today.
Sharon, can you talk about some of the artifacts that people will be looking at?
Yeah, that's the part I really know. So I think what's lovely when you're a curator is, you get an exhibit up, and then right after that, more objects come into the collection. And you're like, oh man, I wish I could have put that on exhibit. And now we have that opportunity. There are a couple that are favorites of mine. One is something that we get to put on exhibit, and that is a major. I mean, it's several feet tall. Japanese vase, beautifully ornate mm-hmm. Piece that came in after the last exhibit. And it has a wonderful story about a man who went to the fair, purchased it, had the means by which to do so, took it back to Springfield where his company was until such time as his family migrated more into the city, and it was handed down from generation to generation. You sometimes wonder if those stories are true or not, but if they're kind of held in family
lore,
that has to be it, right? And so we brought that piece in, and that piece is now on exhibit for the first time, and it's this very gorgeous piece. The other piece that I would mention is that there are a pair of jars that were at the fair. They held, one held tomatoes and one held pears, preserved fruit mm-hmm. at the fair, which would have been a thing. People would have brought their favorite varieties of fruit, just like you do at a state fair, and they would have been on display for people to see. These pieces came to us from our organization, the State Historical Society, saying these came to us from a family. They don't want them anymore. Would you like them? And I was like, that's a little weird, only to know that we could find things very similar in photos of exhibits on the fairgrounds. So I believed them to be true. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this will be so great. We can put these out on exhibit too, only to find out that our conservator said, no, they were too, they're too fragile now. Like they are starting to sort of disintegrate a little bit on the bottom.
Okay.
They still look like pears and tomatoes, and they've now become movie stars because we made a whole video around them.
Oh, I see.
Our fair visitors will also get a chance to understand what we do as an institution when we have to take care of our artifacts in such a way that sometimes they can't actually go on display because of their condition and their fragility. So we have a whole video about that, and it's lovely. There's a reveal in the video where we actually open the box and people see these pears and tomatoes. But again, just the idea that these pieces are 120 years old.
Right, right.
They still look like pears and tomatoes. I mean, I wouldn't want to eat them, but they still look like pears and tomatoes to me.
This episode was produced by Maya Norfleet.
Our audio engineer is Aaron Dorr. This podcast was mixed and edited by Aaron.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
St. Louis on the Air proudly supports local artists by using music from Life Creative Group.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news from the St. Louis region and across Missouri. It also includes stories from the Illinois side of the river and our Metro East reporter, Will Bauer.
In Alton, in Belleville, in East St. Louis, in Edwardsville, in Cahokia Heights, at Scott Air Force Base, I'm Will Bauer, St. Louis Public Radio.
Listen to reports from Will and all of our journalists weekdays on The Gateway, on the STLPR app, and wherever you get podcasts.